Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Monday, March 7th, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for almost 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual tool itself. It's a simple PDF file, deceptively simple, powerful tool. You can download it, print it off, copy it, and use it as often as you'd like, absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you click on that, it'll let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one, where people have either been stepped through that worksheet process or they've called in to give powerful testimonials about how the use of that process has improved the quality of their life. Or some of those shows might be people talking about various situations where they've got questions about the dynamics and how they work. They are very, very useful as a resource. It's absolutely free, and we encourage people to use those archives soon and often, along with the tool itself, because it leads to comments and questions. And when we can get people to call in with those comments and questions, it helps us immensely in living into our intention with this work, which is to be of service. So please let us know how we can be of service to you in application of these tools or clarification of the potential need for these tools. And to do that, give us a call at 563-999-3581 and press 1, or shoot us an email. You can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, or you can email Jeannie Rice at J-E-A-N-I-E at whyagain.org, W-H-Y-A-G-A-I-N.org. And I'm assuming most people who will be emailing are not listening live. So if we get those questions, we will address them to the best of our ability during the show. And when time allows, we'll send a response email that lets you know what day and time we were addressing your question. So since January 10th, we have been working with the Way of Mastery. And we've worked slowly and carefully through the first four lessons. And we did a summary of that on Thursday, which I recommend as a resource. If you haven't been with us since January 10th, you might want to catch up by listening to last Thursday's archive show. And then on Friday, we were addressing some of the questions that came through an email about, so that's February 3rd, archive show is the summary of the first four lessons, and February 4th was the show where we spent the first half of the show discussing one of the biggest traps in work like this, which is to engage the intellect and try to figure things out. And I don't quite have the words for it, because this whole process really is, it's an enigma to the Western mind. And the Western mind wants to learn and wants to grind it out and work hard and master things with the intellect, etc. And this work tells us over and over again, it says right in the first lesson, the way of the heart, which is what this whole first book, 12 lessons, is titled, the way of the heart is not about the intellect. The intellect is meant to be a very simple servant to the awakened heart. It's not intended to be the leader. And so for those of us with the Western mind, to shift away from the intellectual processing and to shift into this allowance state, this openness, this energetic lead, is a very foreign thing. And so that's part of what we were addressing in the first half hour of Friday's show. And then in the second half hour, we talked about Lesson 5. We began the first two pages of Lesson 5. And I don't really have any way of knowing how many times I read each of the first three lessons before even moving on to Lesson 4. But then I had to read Lesson 4 and practice the exercises in it for probably several months before I moved on to Lesson 5. And Lesson 5 is titled, The Keys to the Kingdom. And the kingdom is this, you know, it's a word, it's a euphemism, it's an image for where most of us say we want to be, living in a space that's far more loving, far more fluid, far more productive, far more positive than what happens most of the time for those of us in the Western mind, where we are taught to believe that our emotions are caused by the people and things outside of us, and that we are simply recipients of all of our emotions and all of our reactions. And the truth of it is that there's a way of being in this world that isn't driven by the intellect. So the keys of the kingdom are desire, intention, allowance, surrender, and humility. And if you're most of us from a Western mindset, none of those things sound like what we want to engage in, because that doesn't help us in the world of competition and in dominance and in controlling our world and our lives. So we want to do. We want to figure it out. We want to take action. We want to get it right. We want to, you know, we're living within this thought framework that says we're going to be judged, like the judges at a diving competition or a gymnastics competition or an Olympics competition at the end of our lives or all through our lives. And spiritual schools like this one are trying to get us to wake up to the possibility that there's no one outside of us that's going to judge us any more harshly than we judge ourselves. Spiritual texts like this one are trying to wake us up to the fact that there is a flow of life and creative energy that's going to go on whether we like it or not, and that's going to be influenced subtly but powerfully by where we choose to focus our own mind energy. And if we stay in the trap of the conditioning of the Western culture and we think we've got to figure this out and we've got to do this and we've got to be the driver and director of our lives, then we stay stuck. But if we understand, you know, this isn't kind of, I just got the image of the salmon that swims upstream to spawn, and it's driven by this life force energy that tells it what to do. And here's this metaphor of going against the flow, going against the stream. And yet, all these great spiritual teachings are telling us, look, life is living us. If we learn to go with that and ask to be shown and learn to move in the flow, our life experience will improve exponentially beyond words. And right here at the bottom of the first page of Lesson 5, what we were reading on Friday, says that while the way of the heart does require you to make a commitment and a decision, it's a commitment and a decision to live differently than what you've been trained to do. And he says, I say unto you that when you wholly commit to discovering the way of the heart, which is other than the intellect, when you do that, you will discover a way of being in the world that is not here. You will discover a way of walking through life in which you experience being uplifted by something that seems to be forever beyond you, and yet in that same moment is within you as the core and the essence of your very being. So there's no way the conscious logical mind can understand that. How can you be in the world and not be here? How can you be driven by something that you feel is outside of you and forever beyond your comprehension, and yet have it be the very source of your being? Well, your conscious logical mind will be chewing on that for 100,000 years and never make a dent. And yet, if you step into these practices, if you move into questioning, is it possible that everything I've experienced has been because of how I've chosen to interpret and respond to life events and the flow of life energy? Is it possible that I need do nothing? And so then, rather than using that observation that I need do nothing as an excuse to lay down and do nothing, I use it as the awakened awareness that I'm choosing everything I'm doing. And then I don't bind myself up by feeling condemned and forced and enslaved by life circumstances. Can I open myself to the questions of lesson 3 and 4 that helped me understand the role of my choice in life and my choice of how to interpret and respond to life events is literally the force that creates my experience of them. So this book goes on at the bottom of page 56, lesson 5. Your way, if you do this, if you step into the way of the heart, your way will not be something that the world itself can understand, the external world, the culture and the family that you live in. It won't even be comprehensible with the conscious logical mind within yourself, because you will be living from mystery, and you will be moving from mystery to mystery to mystery. And you will be uplifted and carried by something that brings a satisfaction and a fulfillment to the depth of your soul that's far beyond anything you can imagine with your conscious logical mind. So the question arises, wait a minute, this sounds scary. This sounds like losing control. This sounds like, you know, giving up rather than, you know, taking control and making something happen. So the question is it worth it to commit to the way of the heart? They offer a one-word answer with an exclamation point, yes. Because it culminates with the recognition. It culminates with the recognition that you do not live life at all, but rather that life is living you. One of its characteristics is the development of the witness. The witness is a quality of consciousness. It's a way of being in which you seem to be witnessing everything that arises and flows through you and around you, but you seem to be witnessing it from a place of utter stillness. They go right on to clarify. Stillness does not mean non-activity. Stillness does mean non-attachment to activity, whether the activity be the arising and falling away of cancer in the body, or the arising and falling away of a relationship, or the rising and falling away of a solar system. You discover that there is a place within you that can look upon all things with perfect equanimity, perfect acceptance, and perfect love. For in mastery of the way of the heart, you will discover that nothing is unacceptable to you. Only what is accepted can be transcended. Now, the Western mind is going to scream at this. What about people getting killed in war? What about the genocides that have been perpetrated? What about domestic violence? How can I say nothing is unacceptable to me? Please remember, this is a deeply spiritual text. We're not talking about allowing abuse. We're talking about being able to transcend it. And only what is accepted can be worked with and transcended. Remember, it also said stillness does not mean non-activity. So if I'm seeing somebody being abused, you know, somebody who's weaker being abused by somebody who's stronger, and I'm there and I have either the physical, the mental, and the experiential wisdom about how to intervene to end the abuse, I will probably do so if I'm working with the way of the heart. And I won't be thinking it through at 17 levels before I act. There will be the presence of life unfolding in front of me. I will be in that flow, and my actions will be for the highest and best of everyone involved. And there isn't any way to understand intellectually how that happens. I'm here to tell you this. I've had the life experience of it so many times, because the first 12 to 15 years of my career, I was working in corrections, I was working in jails and juvenile halls and psychiatric hospitals where patients needed to be restrained, therapeutic day schools where, you know, violent teens were being ushered through life. And I was one of those people who was trained over and over and over again how to be in those situations and be one of the people who acts to keep everybody safe. And what was the training? The training was put your conscious logical mind and the emotions that it would generate aside, right? Outside of the workplace, if somebody came up to me and started swearing at me and wanted to punch me in the head, I might get indignantly angry. In the workplace, if it was an inmate or it was a student or it was a patient, I was trained over and over and over again, do not take this personally. This is a person who needs you to be awake and aware in the moment, to draw on your training, to keep everybody safe. Regardless of the insults they may throw at you, at your person, or you, at your mother, or you, at your sister, or you, regardless of the violence coming at you, just come back to the center of the training and let it take over. Act in this way that utilizes, without the distortion of emotion, the clearest observation you can about everything that's going on. And whenever I did that, people would ask me, how did you do that? How did you not get hurt? How did you evade this? And I would have no answer for them because everything just flowed. And that's what this way of the heart is directing us to. So please don't get sidetracked by the thought that so many have in this training that says, wait a minute, how could I move to a place where nothing is unacceptable to me? What about, and the mind lists all of these horrible things that you've seen and judged as bad or wrong. The next statement says, here's why it's unacceptable to you, or it will become acceptable to you, because only what is accepted can be dealt with and transcended. And it happens in the blink of an eye. It happens without all of the intellectual thought. So the text goes on to say, if you do this work, you will discover a way of being in which nothing any longer compels you. You're not even compelled by the desire to know God, because the need of that will have been completed. And I think I mentioned on Friday, this reminds me when I read that, of something that came to me several years ago where I was just coming up from a nap or sleep or something, and I thought, you know what? Only the ego wants to know God. And that struck me as so deeply true. It took me quite a while to sort out at an intellectual level what that might mean. But these texts tell us we are connected to our source. Always, regardless of what our conscious logical mind might say. So we will discover a way of being where nothing compels us. We need do nothing. We don't even need to know God, because that idea that I need to know God means I've separated me from my source. I've created an experience of being separated from my source, which never happened. It's a hallucination. It's an illusion. The reason there will be no need to know God is the need of it has been completed. Then there arises a way of being in the world that is indeed not here, for you will feel no restlessness and no need to direct your journey. No questions will arise. Well, in order for questions to not arise, it means I will have had to put my intellectual, conscious, logical mind in its proper place as a servant, as a tool. Think about it. A master carpenter doesn't use a hammer for everything. It's a specific tool. It's used for specific things. A master carpenter has a wealth of tools to draw from and uses them only as needed. My intellect, your intellect, is just a faithful servant. It's a tool to be used in certain situations. Where this says no questions will arise, that means because you won't be driven by your intellect, which is always churning questions, which always wants to be in control, which always wants to understand everything in terms that it's, Michael Rice would say, the 9-bit mind can comprehend. And as we say so often in this work, there's a lot more going on here than your 9-bit mind will ever comprehend. So the text says, no questions will arise. You will be at peace. In that peace, the breath of God will move through you. And you will become as the world, as the wind, knowing not where you come from or where you are going, but you will abide in perfect trust and perfect rest. The world may not know you, but your Creator will know you, and you will know your Creator. Now, this is not something your conscious logical mind will ever wrap itself around. So you're going to have to, if you want to be on this path, if you want to get into the mastery of the way of the heart, again, mastery does not arise from hard work. Mastery arises from innocence, as we're told in the first 3 chapters. Can I move into the place of innocence, of not knowing, whether it's in this work or some other work? I remember hearing the term divine ignorance, deep knowing that I don't know, and not digging for the answer. It's what the master poet Rainer Maria Rilke will tell us is so needed. We need to learn to live in the question. Why? Because in the moment a mind asks a question, a really good question, that mind is not capable of comprehending the answer. That mind needs to grow through experience to expand, to become aware of new options and new layers of being before it can understand the answer to a really good question. Rilke says, if the answer came to us in that moment, it would be like the chitterings of a language we don't know from the outside, beyond several veils from a different dimension. So we need to learn to live in that open space of questioning. And as Rilke says, and then we might live along someday into the answer. The text goes on to say, in the way of the heart, the most primary and fundamental perception that seems to fuel ordinary human consciousness has finally been transcended. So, let's just read that sentence again. There's so much in that sentence. In the way of the heart, which is what this first 12 lessons in this book that's called The Way of Mastery, what the first 12 lessons are directing us to is a series of practices, a series of experiential steps that we can commit to and practice as often as we're called to do it. Not with beating ourselves up if we miss a day or two, but as it arises, once we've asked, rest assured, the answer will be coming. In the way of the heart, the most primary and fundamental perception, your perception, my perception, I look out, I hold up my right hand because the left hand is holding the book I'm reading from. I hold up my right hand, I spin it back and forth, I look at it, I feel it, I see it, it pats the book. That level of perception, that stuff that seems to fuel my ordinary human consciousness, that's the stuff my conscious logical mind uses to perceive the world and judge the world and in its convoluted sense, working with the world, controlling the world. In the way of the heart, that fundamental perception has been finally transcended. So it isn't even just that I learned to meditate, because for most people, when they sit down to meditate, the conscious logical mind is still trying to direct the meditation. It's still trying to get a sense of what their body is and where their body begins and ends and watch the breathing and this and that. Maybe they've been given a meditation practice from their guru or teacher or sensei. So they're using their conscious logical mind to try to get the meditation right. This book says, in the way of the heart, the most fundamental primary perception that seems to fuel your ordinary human consciousness is finally transcended. The perception of a separate maker and a doer has been dissolved. And once again, you will understand the depth and the profundity of the simple terms of this sentence. Here's the sentence. Of myself, I do nothing. But through me, the Creator does all things. I am simply the extension of creative energy manifesting in form, as are you and everyone you ever deal with. The text goes on to say, to rest in such a perception means that you have come to realize that the little s self that you are is merely a conduit through which mystery lives itself, through which capital L love pours forth. So here's another name for creation, for God, for light, for love, mystery. It said earlier at the top of the page, you will be moving and living from mystery to mystery to mystery. And you'll be uplifted and carried by something that brings a depth of satisfaction and fulfillment to the depth of your soul that goes beyond anything your conscious logical mind can imagine. So mystery is another name for creation itself, for God, for light, for love. To rest in the perception that the way of the heart will bring means that you have come to realize that the self that you are is merely a conduit through which mystery lives itself, through which love pours forth. You will realize that there is nothing to be gained or lost in this world for you at that level. That level of awareness and existence and connection to your source means there's no attachment to activity. There's no attachment to belongings. There's allowance and surrender and humility. You will know what it means to recognize that you literally have nowhere to go and nothing to achieve. You will become, and these words don't mean much right now, but the words are empty and spacious. And I say that because when I first read this, I thought I knew what the word empty meant. I thought I knew what the word spacious means. Today, many years after first picking up this book and working with this, I have the inkling that I have no idea. So I moved from thinking I knew to absolutely knowing I have no idea. The text goes on to say, and yet paradoxically, while the body lasts, you will appear just as everybody else appears. You'll arise in the morning and brush your teeth. When the body is hungry, you will feed it. You will laugh with your friends. You will yawn when the body is a bit tired. And yet, through it all, there will be a quality of awareness. We called it the witness earlier, that is simply watching all, waiting to be moved by the wind of spirit, capital S, spirit. Though others may not see it, virtually everything you utter will carry the sound of truth. And I want to highlight here that while others may not see it, you won't care if they see it. You're not going to be attached to the hallucinations, the illusions, the bitternesses and the resentments that you used to have or that others still do have. The text goes on to say, you will not know how Spirit will work through you, nor will you care. And I just have to stop there because this is the kind of thing that trips most of us up. Most of us who go onto a spiritual path from the Western mind, we think it's our job to be good, deep spiritual students and to be good at being spiritual and to be good people and to work hard, and we care how Spirit's going to work through us. We want to see that what we did helped our brother or sister. We want to make sure we're saying the right thing and doing just the right thing. This work is pointing us to an entirely different level or dimension of experience where we understand it isn't us. We don't have to get invested in it. We don't care. We trust the flow of the creative energy through us. We trust that if we get enough of our bloated nothingness out of the way, as Emerson would say, if we get enough of our desire and ego and obsession and craving out of the way, what flows through us is going to be in perfect alignment with what is needed to serve the soul of our brother and sister, to serve our own growth, and we're not going to be attached to a certain manifestation of it that looks like this or that. So again, if anybody's trying to follow along, we're at the beginning of the second paragraph on page 58. It says, you will not know how Spirit will work through you, nor will you care. Because you see, when there is no maker or doer or director, it will not matter to you. That is what it means to live as the wind. For the wind does not concern itself with where it has been or where it is going. The wind is moved by some mysterious source that cannot be located at all. Yet it blows, and as it blows, its effect is experienced. In this way, you will become like the wind. And any tendency people have to give the power and the credit and the glory to you will be completely misplaced, because they're going to be aligned with you and they're thinking, hey, if I put this person up on a pedestal and I say, this is the one who healed me, or this is the one who taught me, or I just flashed on somebody I knew. And she's a lovely person. And yet there's this one characteristic that just really stuck out with me for her. Whenever she found a tool or a technique, she was a therapist, whenever she found it, she wouldn't take the training until she could sign up with the person that created the technique. Now, that person might have had, 30 or 40 different trainers working for him or her, and there might have been, two or three of them that were within an hour's drive of this therapist. She wouldn't go to them. Even if they studied directly with her, the woman who created the technique, she would only go to the training if she could go to the person that created. And then she would talk about how, ooh, I studied with so-and-so, and she's the one who created this technique. I studied with so-and-so, and she's the one who created that technique. And it was a status thing for her. What the way of the heart is telling us is, when we get into the flow of the way of the heart, none of that's going to matter to us. We will not know how the Spirit will work through us, and we won't care. We'll understand that there is no maker or doer or director, so it won't matter to us. We're not living from that ego. We're not living from that conscious, logical, egoic mind, that intellectual mind that's always comparing and judging and thinking in terms of status and competition. And we'll soften, we'll breathe, we'll be in the moment, we'll ask what's ours to do to bless ourselves and others, and whatever happens, we will allow it, we will surrender to it, and we'll move through it. just like the wind. The wind isn't judging what effect it's had. It just does its work and moves on. The next paragraph reads, imagine then a life in which all that you do is not for yourself. Imagine a way of life in which what you do is not for anyone else. Imagine, if you will, a way of life in which creativity, right, the energy of creation, flows forth from a source so deep within you and around you that no language or dogma can contain it. A force and a source that knows how to express itself through you in such a way that it is constantly and only serving the atonement, the awakening of all creation to the truth of creation's presence. Imagine that. I'm going to read that paragraph again because it is so outside everything we've been taught with our conscious, logical, egoic mind in the Western world. Imagine, if you will, a life in which all that you do is not for yourself, it's not for God, it's not for anybody else, it's not for your family, it's not for your nation. Imagine, if you will, a way of life in which what you do is not for anyone else. Imagine a way of life in which creativity flows forth. You're that conduit through which this creative energy is flowing into the physical world. And it's flowing from a source so deep within you and around you that there is no language that can contain it. No dogma, no religious belief, no spiritual practice can contain it. It's a force and a source that knows. It comes from an intelligence that goes beyond our intellectual capacity to fathom. This source knows how to express itself through you in such a way that it is constantly and only serving the atonement, the at-one-ment, the awakening of all of creation to the truth of life, which is everything is connected. There is only the creative flow. There is only the creator and the creation, and it's all the same thing. The text goes on to say, the way of the heart does indeed unfold along a certain pathway. In this lesson, we will address the stages of that pathway in a general sense, right? There is no step-by-step manual. Do this pranayama breathing, do this sitting pose, do this walking meditation. There is no step-by-step process like that. But in a general sense, this work will outline a pathway. And then we will speak of the most important characteristic to be cultivated along this pathway. That characteristic is contained in one of the things that we already read. You know, this whole idea that in the way of the heart, the most primary and fundamental perception that seems to fuel your ordinary human consciousness will have been completely, finally transcended. The perception of yourself as a separate maker or doer will be dissolved. And once again, you will understand with a new depth, you'll understand how profound this is in terms that go beyond the words. And here's the statement, of myself, I do nothing. But through me, the Creator does all things. And that is the most important characteristic to be cultivated along this path. To say it in a word, it's humility. It's the open awareness that I don't even know how I digest the food I eat. I have no idea how and when and where and why I was created. and to create a set of thoughts about that, a set of beliefs about that, a set of wishes, desires, dogmas about that is farcical. It doesn't touch the depth and the profundity of the truth of life. And the truth of life is expressing in, through, as, and around you in each moment. And when you start to awaken to that in a way that's completely different than everything you've been taught by your culture and your family and your favorite teachers, you move into an experience of yourself as part of this open conduit expressing the creative energy and form, and you learn to live in the mystery. You learn to ask again and again and again without demanding an answer. That's what the way of the heart is about, moving out of the intellect into the openness of the awakened heart. The text goes on to say the first key is desire. Now the last lesson, the entire lesson, was on desire. So if you have any question about this, if you've got any emotional loadings for the word desire, please review lesson 4. The text reads, first, desire is everything. Without it, nothing can arise. Therefore, what you desire is of the utmost importance. This is not about I desire ice cream or I desire money or I desire a sexual partner or I desire the stereo. What you desire is of the utmost importance. So here's the recommendation. Desire then to be aware of your perfect union with the forces that created you. Desire then to be an aspect of the Christ mind incarnate. Desire then to be all that your Creator has created you to be, and understand that you cannot possibly have any idea what that might be, because the ideas you have about it are not the same as the thing. Krishnamurti spent decades trying to get us to understand the word is not the thing. The word is a symbol of a symbol. The thing exists somewhere outside of us. Light or sound or touch comes off of that. An impression is formed in our senses. Our mind creates a picture of it. That picture is a picture of the impressions. And then we put a word to the picture. So we are several levels removed from the truth of life every time we use a word. So desire is the key. Desire is everything. It's the flow of life. It's the energy that carries any impression that we might turn into a craving or a desire or a wish. Without that energy of desire, without the energy of creation that wants to express uniquely through you in each moment, there can be nothing that arises. Therefore, what you desire is really important. It's of the utmost importance. Here's a thought. Why not desire to be on the team aligned with the flow of creation itself? Why not go with the most winning, the most ineffable, the most powerful, the most unstoppable energy expressing in physical form that there is? You know, choose well. Choose the winning team. Desire then to be Christ incarnate, to be aware of your of the truth that you are part of the Christ mind, of the one mind. Desire then to be all that the Creator has created you to be, and understand that you have no idea what that might be like. The next paragraph on that page reads, for when you hold desire within your beingness, and when you have mastered, remember, a mastery arises from innocence, you've mastered the energy of desire, by being open to it, by allowing it, by studying it, by accepting it, and knowing you don't have to do everything that the impressions that arise in your mind tell you to do. But when you've mastered the energy of desire, again, mastery does not mean control, but you're grounding it always in the desire to be as you are created to be, then indeed all of your life and all of the subsequent or subsidiary desires will come to serve the one grand desire of the creation itself. When you come to that state of being, nothing shall be impossible to you. Why? Because you're not the one doing it. You're merely a piece of thread in a very cosmic tapestry that's been woven by the Creator of all creation. It who alone knows how to weave the tapestry of a new age, a new paradigm, of a healing of this plane and of humanity. So the first stage is the stage of desire. Only by feeling desire and not suppressing it and not judging it, not shying away from it, only by feeling it and not suppressing it can you truly begin to move toward the stage of mastery in which the energy of desire always serves the higher will, which is the will of the Creator for you. As we have said to you before, when your will is in alignment with the will of the Creator, you will discover that the Creator's will for you is that you be genuinely happy through and through, content, fulfilled, at peace, empowered, capable, and responsible. So I looked up and realized that there's only about 7 or 8 minutes left, and that's the first key. The second key is intention. We don't really have time to get into that and finish it within our first hour today, so I'll leave it at that. I thank you all for being here and joining us on this little journey, this little excursion. We do have time if somebody would like to make a comment before we start our second hour today. We have no less than 10 people listening in on the phone queue. There might be some listening in through chat rooms or internet connections. 563-999-3581 is the number. If you'd like to make a comment or ask a question, call that number and press 1. Otherwise, I'll prepare us for our second hour. The second hour today is going to be a taped replay of something related to the Kabbalist manuscript. Michael and Jeannie are otherwise occupied for the next hour today. I'm sure that they will be back in the near future to carry on our second hour. But if you have a comment or a question, we still have a few minutes left. Otherwise, I will start that second hour audio and move us on into the second hour, and then we'll look forward to coming back tomorrow and moving on through the fifth lesson in the Way of the Heart. I'll remind us all that we have this option for a Mind Shifter support group again on Tuesdays and Thursday nights, so tomorrow night and again on Thursday night. I will remind us all that I have been involved for the past 2 years in another project which provides, I think, very useful resources for people absolutely free, and that is the On Your Mind podcast hosted by Journey's Dream. And if you would like to take advantage of that, you can go to journeysdream.org, all one word, journeysdream.org/podcast. And there you'll find probably at least 90 over the past 2 years interviews with people that they either know of, they work at, or they run residential centers to help people work through their mental health challenges, either with little or no meds or with lots and lots of nutritional aids and orthomolecular healthy gut biome aids, etc., as well as therapy techniques. There are talks there from people who work with people when they've had a psychotic break, and they do early interventions for that. There are talks there with people who are integrative psychiatrists and functional medicine physicians and psychiatrists. And there are interviews there of people who had their own mental health challenges and come out on the other side and found them to be transformational and life-enhancing rather than life-devastating. Area code 904. You're in the air if we're lucky.
Yes, hi. My name's Dusty. Can you hear me?
I can barely hear you. Go ahead.
Yes.
Say your name again.
Dusty.
Dusty. Welcome,
and
Dusty.
Thank you. I got into the program late, but it sounded to me, and I have this vision, you used the word desire. Krishnamurti, was that Krishnamurti's reading stuff you were reading?
No, I was reading The Way of Mastery.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't catch that part. But that thing about desire, I mean, it sounds like it is such a my mind right now see it as a bit of a funnel with desire in the center, you know what I mean? And I wonder if you could comment on that particular desire, the center part of that desire that was being talked about. It very helpful here.
Well, I would redirect you to the show on Thursday last week where I did a summary. I did a review of the first four lessons, or, you know, any one of the ones in the archive we read through lesson four in The Way of Mastery twice, very slowly, very carefully. And lesson four is all about this energy of desire, the way of mastery wants us to explore it. And the way of desire is pretty much the opposite of any craving, any obsession, any passion that we might have with the conscious logical mind. And my summary statement for it is that the way it's being talked about in this work, the energy of desire, instead of using the word desire because of all the mental, emotional attachments we have for that word, use the phrase, the energy of creation that wants to express uniquely through you in each moment. That's really what this lesson is talking about, what the way of the heart is talking about when it uses the word desire.
Gotcha. That's beautiful. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for the call. I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. And welcome to the second hour today, the Kabbourist Show.
People interested in the Kabbourist manuscript, there are the, if you click on Kabbourist manuscript, you can go to the Enlightenment. You can see the history of the Kabbourist. There's pictures. There's every page of the Kabbourist and an introduction to it. There's all kinds of information there about that manuscript. And that is, it was found on the Kabbour River. And that's what the translation has been, what has been done out of the Kabbourist. And that's the text that we use. So Michael has now joined us, so I'll welcome Michael.
Thank you, dear heart, and I just caught the tail end. I had trouble dialing in today, so I just caught the tail end of the discussion about the divorce. There's some questions about it. You've gone silent, Jeannie. You must have pushed your mute button.
Well, I'm sitting here talking with my mute button on. No, there wasn't a question about it. I was just filling in time until you got on the switchboard and pointing out things that are on our website that a lot of people maybe don't click, and, you know, what they can find and information that's out there for free. And so I was just pointing that out. So there's nobody but me in the chat room, and there's no questions, no hands up on the switchboard.
Well, let's talk about the Kiboris a little bit. And there's a gentleman named Dan McDougald. Everybody called him Mr. Mac. And he was an attorney in Atlanta and became interested. Actually, he was doing some work with a spy agency in England, and the British intelligence suggested it was a thing. As an attorney for him, it was there was a deep interest in how people can lie and really appear to believe their lies are true, and then do behaviors that go flat in the face of everything they committed to and everything that they say, but doing the exact opposite, much as we're seeing, you know, a whole lot of that happening in the political process today. So that's what got Dan interested in British intelligence. Said, well, if you're going to resolve this problem, here's the place to test it. And if you can resolve it here, then you'll resolve it in the world. And so he started to work with the first century Aramaic language in resolving conflict with truth with prisoners, and that was Dan's interest. And they were working actually initially with a 7th century text of based in the Aramaic language, and that text was incomplete. It was called the Yonan Codex. You might see some reference to that, and in fact there's some conflicting information around where one person in particular, who's a fairly well-known Aramaicist, was really knocking the Kiboris. But then he found out, and I actually ended up presenting him the Kiboris. He's like, oh, this isn't the manuscript I was talking about. He had confused the Yonan with the Kiboris. So Dan funded an expedition to go to the Middle East and find an earlier complete text, because the 7th century text, of course, had gone through several centuries, and it was not complete. So he found a complete Eastern canon of the New Testament in a monastery on the Kaibor River in Turkey. If you go to yagan.org, our website, Jeannie was talking about that, you can click on the Kiboris manuscript and you'll see pictures of it. There are actually pictures of every page in the manuscript. It's beautiful. And there's some pictures of when I brought it to Heartland as I was traveling and working with getting high-resolution images made of the manuscript so that we could preserve it and do a deeper level of work in it. So Dan worked with that, and Dan and I met and discovered our mutual interest in the Aramaic language, and in particular the Aramaic teachings of Yeshua. And we discovered that we had been traveling parallel roads. I had a thing called Lessons in Living. Actually, it's still being taught down in a school where I started it, though, 35 years ago in South Florida, in Delray Beach at the Unity Center there. And Dan was teaching a thing called Emotional Maturity Instruction, which he had developed for the prisons. Our mutual interest, we discovered that we had been traveling similar but different paths, working with the Aramaic, and mine was more oriented being a naturopath with the health direction, and his was more oriented to the justice system. And we married our work, and the results of that, we put the work together and developed a course called Laws of Living. And, of course, that's what we're teaching in February. And that's based on, in particular, the work of 25 translators. 25 of the world's top Aramaicists worked on the Kiboris manuscript, actually back in the 70s until the project ran out of money. The manuscript itself was put on the shelf at that point. And when I became involved, that's when we took it down off the shelf. We're looking to get high-resolution images made so that the text could be preserved. And so when, if you're interested in a deeper look at the Aramaic, then you might want to think about the Laws of Living Intensive that we'll be doing. It will be here in Southwest Virginia, Eastern Tennessee area, about 15, 20 minutes from Bristol, Tennessee, Virginia. It's a split city. Actually, if you drive down, if somebody drives down the main street of the town of Bristol, the center line of the road is the state line. And so if they weave, they're drunk and they weave, they can get tickets in two states. So we're on the Virginia side, and then about 15 minutes up the road, there's a really beautiful retreat center called Jubilee House, and we'll be doing a 16-day residential intensive Laws of Living at Jubilee House. And it's done in a whole, if you've done some of the other intensives, it's done in a whole different way from our normal intensive work. We do it in the Socratic method of questions. There's a text, about 250 pages that we go through. Their essays, there are several different tools that we introduce. And we're looking to understand, and many people have this understanding of law as the rule of a superior. Kings want you to believe that when a king says go, his word is law. You've maybe even heard that from one of your parents. My word is law in this house, as the law with the rule of a superior. And most of the so-called justice system works on that premise, but it's a totally false premise. That's not what law means at all in the original first century Aramaic. And our Laws of Living course is not about, well, here's a set of rules that some creator somewhere says you better obey or you're in trouble. You'll be punished or, you know, chastised or what have you, rejected, excommunicated, well, whatever. But rather, the word law represents an understanding of the energy system in which we live, move, and have our being, our relationship with those energy forces, and how they work. You know, an example of that would be the law of gravity. You know, the law of gravity operates whether you like it or not. It's independent of any rule maker. It's just the way the gravity system works. You know, if you fly an airplane, you don't violate the law of gravity. Well, of course you have to violate the law of gravity, Michael, to take a machine that's heavier than air and make it fly. Well, no, actually you don't. You create forces called propulsion that are stronger than the forces created by the law of gravity, and your airplane flies. If you violate the way it works for 1 second in that airplane crashes. If you violate the way the energy field works in relationship to health for 1 second, then health begins to crash. If you violate the way the energy field works in regard to nutrition, and we go into nutrition deeply in this course, then the energy field begins to crash. If you violate the way that sexuality works, then your sexuality, your life will begin to collapse. You know, in each area there are laws. And it's not about obeying some superior. It's about here's how the eternal energy forces work. And you come into conscious relationship with them, just like the engineer comes into conscious relationship with gravity. You get to fly airplanes. You get to go to space. How cool is that? But only because you understood how those eternal forces operated and you lived in harmony with those eternal forces, knowing that to violate them for 1 second was destruction. And it's the same. And it isn't. And the destruction isn't about being punished. It's just about here's how the energy field works. And sadly, when the Aramaic language, it's interesting, that language in which the Kabbalah is written is the root language of at least six of the world's major religions. And there's a reason for that, and it's got nothing to do with religion. It is a language that has a comprehension of how these eternal forces operate and how to come into relationship with and understand that. But the misinterpretation and the mistranslation of those words, and we go back and we listen to Vladimir Lenin, he says if you change the meaning of a culture's words, you can destroy that culture. Why would that be? Because culture is transferred among humans by and large via words. If you have different meanings in your brain cells for a particular set of words, than the words that describe accurately how these eternal forces operate, then you can never come into relationship with those eternal forces using the meanings of those words. And virtually every major key word that's important to life has been changed by the Greeks. For instance, law. It's been made into the rule of a superior. Nothing to do with it. And, you know, when I introduced people first to the Aramaic, and it's been a while since I've shared this story on the show, so I'll share it at this moment. I tell a story about, you know, imagine that we're doing a week of workshops at a particular location, and we hear from a fellow in Russia who wants to come and join us for the workshops. And let's imagine you are the best translator of Russian into English and English into Russian in the world. You are the best. And I know that you're coming to the workshops and that you live locally and you're going to be attending the workshops. And I know you have an extra room in your house. So I communicate to you. We heard from this fellow in Russia. He only speaks Russian and he wants to come to the workshops. Would you house him and, you know, transport him and translate for him? And you say, I'd be delighted to. And over the period of the week, you and I get together, and he get together, the group that's attending the workshop. We have dinner. We maybe have lunch once or twice, and it's just great. We do the mind shifters and still part breathing on Saturday. We have an awesome result. He just gets this huge opening and is so delighted with it. And as you're getting ready to take him back to the airport, you know, I want to communicate to this man how deeply I regard him, and I ask him if you would please tell him that I think that he's really cool. And you say, sure, I'll tell him. And you turn to him in your best Russian, and you say to him, Michael thinks you've got a low body temperature. You translated my words perfectly. You didn't say anything about what I meant, but you translated my words perfectly. Oh, yes, yeah, some of those Greek translators were some of the finest in the world, but they didn't have a clue the meaning of the idioms in the Aramaic that are key to understanding the culture that lives in harmony with these laws. That is, lives in harmony with the way this energy system works, mentally, physically, emotionally, sexually, relationship, financial. Every arena, there are laws for how the system works. Violate the laws, you're in trouble. There's difficulty. Not because a superior said, look at this, you broke my rules. No, no. So we distinguish all of that and help people to build the brain cells and engage in exercises for moving the brainwashed part of the mind out of the way, that is forgiveness. First century Aramaic forgiveness has to do with undoing the information within us that is of a destructive nature that allows us to misinterpret and misunderstand. You know, what would the guy who hears, I think he's got a low body temperature, think when you tell him that? What would he think of me? Does he think I'm, you know, who do I think I am? How do I dare tell him he's got, you know, what might go on in his mind? And so we have this misinterpretation that is universal of so many key words. And so Laws of Living is about straightening out those definitions and providing tools for cleaning up the mind and getting back into harmony with living as truly as a human being. If you're back to Yeshua, you'll notice, well, most of the churches have this really important dogma, and I think we're at about 32,000 sects of Christianity, each with a different dogma. Here's what I believe it meant. This is the dogma in order to be part of our church that you have to believe. And by the way, if you don't believe this, this eternal punisher, it's going to send you to a hot, fiery place for life. Dogma, doctrine. You'll notice that Yeshua had a different purpose. What did Yeshua say? He said, I come to bring you life, and life more abundant. This was not to teach you some kind of religious doctrine or dogma. His purpose was to bring you an understanding through words and tools how to live as a human being. And what is a human being? And this is our whole purpose of Laws of Living. It's the purpose of everything we do. Pardon me. What is a human being? Well, that definition has been so distorted that it includes all kinds of crazy things, but I would offer that most of what the world believes about human beings, you know, when people are frail and faulty and do something simple, they say, well, after all, I'm only human. Well, that's all falsehood. That's all based in the same kind of misunderstanding of you've got a low body temperature. Hold a newborn child and you get to experience what human life is. When you hold that newborn child, notice that the newborn is not loving you. This is another word that's been mistranslated. We're told, oh, you're supposed to love your neighbor. Yeshua never said that. Hold a newborn. Is the newborn loving you or is the newborn love? No question about it. The newborn is love. Yeshua said, I come to bring you that life and life more abundantly. You'll notice the repeated references to love, and the Greeks translated into, and you know, how many crazy different things do we have about love in this culture? Love is sexual athletics. Love is put your head on the chopping block so I can cut it off and abuse you, and you can say, oh, look, I sacrificed for you. All kinds of insane definitions of love. When the truth is, love is the essence of human life. It is a state of being. It is what we are. And Yeshua, we could restate his words about the purpose of his life and his work. And he said, I come to bring you the experience of living as love and bring that experience more abundantly. In other words, fill in every gap in every moment of your life. And that's how human life works. When they, you know, you hear them, the disciples saying, well, you know, you're telling us all this stuff. What's most important in all this stuff you're teaching us? What's number one? Did he say love your neighbor? No. The Greeks tell us he said love your neighbor. And the Greeks went off in a direction. And now in the name of loving our neighbors, what do we have? Religious wars, left, right, center, up, down, rejection, murder, I mean, mayhem. What he said was not love your neighbor, love the Creator as yourself. In Aramaic, first century language, properly translated, he said maintain rachma, which is a filter in the frontal lobes of the brain. The Greeks mistranslated that as love, the same way as our translator who told our Russian friend he has a low body temperature, as he translated my words, I think you're really cool, meaning I think you're the cat's meow, you're awesome, you're wonderful, but now it's become a low body temperature kind of thing. It's just totally distorted. And so what Yeshua said is maintain this condition of rachma, which in Aramaic is a gateway in the frontal lobes of the brain that is the entryway for human life into human form and keeps the human mind on track with its true nature, which is love. If hostility or fear rears its head and you do behaviors based in hostility or fear, you have violated the laws for living a human life. Now, that doesn't mean that some superior is peeved at you because you didn't do what you were told to do. It just means that you've stepped out of harmony with that which causes a human life to go forward and be maintained. And if you do that, you can't have life more abundantly. So it's, and it, you know, Grady made the point, I think it was Grady made the point on yesterday's show about just how this work is so imminent. It's here. It's not about some afterlife. It's not about some esoteric something. It's the truth of how we live today in relationship with each other as human beings and stop the lie that we're, when we're in hostility and fear and puking on somebody else, when we're being pissy with somebody else, that it's their fault and they deserved it. And stop the conversations about them and start having a conversation about yourself and clean up your own mind, because if you don't, you throw away through hostility and fear your own human life and your own human physiology will start to fall apart. And the result of that is death. What was that statement? The wages of sin is death. Now, what did the Greeks translate that one as? Oh, if you do something that this superior doesn't like, then you are going to die. You know, just, the Creator is going to get you. As opposed to the imminent understanding, the understanding that makes it imminent in life, that if I engage in energies that are off the mark, the word sin in Aramaic is an archery term, and it simply means you missed the bullseye. So if I engage in energy that's off the mark, the result is, if I continue to do that, I will die because I put disintegrative energies into my tissue structure each time I quote unquote sin, each time I engage in hate and fear and rage and guilt and grief and gossip and slander and vengeance and abuse of my neighbor or myself or my spouse or my children or my parents. Instead of maintaining rachma and understanding the imminent domain of the law. Ah, when I keep this gateway open, I stay in touch with, I live in relationship with the truth of who I am. I live as love, as I am. And when hostility or fear comes up in me, I recognize that it's a generational pattern that tends to run my life. In fact, it's mostly a power person dynamic that runs my life. Then I apply forgiveness, nothing to let somebody else off the hook for what they need, or because I'm in violation of the energy that I live, move, and have my being in. But as I remove the energy that violates, then healing occurs, and a whole different game starts to happen. And so that's what we're here to understand in the Kabbalists, or from the Kabbalists and from the first century teachings of the man named Yeshua. So I hope that gives you a picture of a little bit about the manuscript and what the core of it's about. And our objective, of course, with this work is to enter into the practice of functioning as the conscious, active presence of love 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and to be able to hold that space for each other whenever any of us has fallen out of harmony. And, of course, you go back and, you know, the Greeks will beat you up over this one. And say, well, we've all fallen short. Yeah, we've all fallen out of harmony with how the energy system works. Does that mean somebody deserves to be condemned? No. But rather that we're in the space of holding to active love to assist in the support and the repair of whatever's going on in the energy system that might be off base. And so, you know, the whole objective of an intensive, we've had, you know, several people from last summer's intensives calling into the show on occasion, and the support that's there and developing for each other as those layers that perhaps, you know, haven't been looked at in 100 generations in any of our bloodlines. As each individual says, okay, wow, I start to look back. Jeannie and I went to the movies last night and saw the film Judy,
Garland.
Judy Garland. Judy Garland. Awesome film. Both of us ended up in tears toward the end of it to watch how this young girl from Michigan somewhere was discovered and how the movie studios executives basically manipulated her into becoming a child star. She starred in, you know, true story, she starred in The Wizard of Oz as Dorothy. And, you know, they forced her to become, as a young child, drug dependent because they were afraid she'd put on weight partway through the film, and she couldn't do that. So, you know, there's one scene where she's sitting with Mickey Rooney there. She's got a crush on Mickey Rooney, and he's eating a hamburger. They're in a restaurant, and she has a matron who kind of looks over her, you know, takes care of her for the studio, and she wants a bite of his hamburger, and the matron comes over and says, no, you can't get fat while you're doing this movie, and hands her an amphetamine pill. This is your lunch. And hooks her on pills, and the rest of her life is drug addiction and the challenges she goes through, and at the age of 47 was dead of an overdose. Abuse that started in early childhood, the lack of rock, the lack of love, and the pursuit of money. How bizarre. It's very touching, and it very distinctly shows how when she went through, I think, five different marriages, And each time she was married, the power person shows how the studio executive just degrades her and drags her through the dirt to force her to do his bidding in this movie. And power person dynamic, you see it being instilled in her mind. You know, here's somebody who's got more control over her life than she does. He's always threatening her with taking away her movie, you know, life that's going to be her future, that'll be so wonderful for her, ends up being a tragedy. And what does she do in her marriages when the stress is up? She turns to the same kind of abuse that was done to her and ended up at 47 dead from a drug overdose. Bizarre. And how do we repair a life like that? Well, you step in, and piece by piece by piece, you undo the power person dynamics. You live in a space where you're willing to be responsible for those dynamics. You're willing to be supportive in healing them. You're willing to confront them, although it's not Dr. Feelgood. You're willing to step out of the defense mechanism that the power person used, which is usually some form of attack or what have you, or degradation that's used, vicious energy towards others, especially those who are closest. You have to own those and choose to begin to forgive, to remove those energetic patterns, to step into still another place. And the whole body of work, the reason for this show, is to be here of support for moving through those things. And so we're here to hold the space and appreciate each of you who's there to really truly be the space for the process that each of us are going through as this healing unfolds. And speaking of healing, I got a call from a friend of mine last night, and he was sharing that he just had a diagnosis from his medical doctor that left him in a pretty traumatic place. His name's Steve, and I'll just ask everybody to just tap into Steve's energy, and everyone here participating in intensives is such as developing intuition, so we can stand in that space of active present love and just see Steve's chest and lungs being radiated with the active presence of love, that whatever anomalies are going on in tissue, and they don't have it down to an exact diagnosis. They've given him two or three scary things that might be going on. And he's a deep friend of this work, has done this work for several decades. Used to be a participant in our workshops in Florida way back in the early days of developing this work. So, Steve, we cherish you, we honor you, we hold the space for you. And especially for, you know, if there's any kind of mental, emotional component involved with what's happening in your physiology, we hope that that can be forgiven, be removed, and totally reorganize your energy system to a state of awesome, perfect, vital health. Steve's just this awesome man that's been around in my world for the last 30, almost 40 years. And so we care for him deeply. And see if we hold the space for your healing. And anyone else that's facing financial, relationship, emotional, physical challenges, we hold the space for healing. And it is that awesome presence of true active love that when it comes forward, enters into the space of physiology where distortions have occurred, or into emotions where distortions have occurred, or into the mind where distortions have occurred, and reorganizes that structure into health and wholeness. You know, the whole bottom line of healing, you know, having done this work for almost 50 years, I can think back to, you know, I don't know, 20, 25 years ago when I started really questioning what is healing? What is it that makes the difference? What on the occasions where I've seen people who have head issues that are really, in the normal sense of the world, absolutely unresolvable. And as I start to question and ask to be shown what is it, what creates that change in energy, what became clear to me as I look back over the previous couple of decades of doing this work is each time I saw someone making that kind of monumental shift, two things had occurred. Something that was in hiding within the mind, something that someone had been in denial of, and remember our definition of denial is when I think or speak as though something outside of me is the cause of something inside of me. So the bottom line of healing is that when one can step out of denial and allow, you know, if there's pain in your structure, you're in denial. That's just the way it is. And so are you willing to step into a space of opening that part of your mind? And it might mean facing some pretty deep power person dynamics. Are you willing to open that and to let that energy come forward in the presence of love? And you can't do that without the willingness to look at what's there. You know, oftentimes people will feel attacked if they're shown where their deficiency or their weakness is. When, in fact, the idea is to just look at the truth and to be able to see truly what's going on and have access to that deeper hidden part of the mind. There's no idea of attack and saying, gee, did you notice that you did thus and so? Now, the average person, when you show them where the blockage of truth is, they'll go into attack mode and puke on you for how dare you say such a thing. That's not what it's about. It's about you have to be able to look at what your energy field is doing and see the truth of it in order to bring correction. So what became very clear to me is that when someone was able to bring something out of hiding in their minds, which is their body literally, and bring that energy forward in the presence of active love, and I mean that love has to be conscious, active, and present. Human life has to be in conscious awareness and operating in that space. And when that love is present and we willingly step into looking at the dis-ease energy, instead of feeling attacked when we're shown where our blockage is, to go, oh, is it possible that I'm blocking in that? Well, gee, you know, 87 different times with 42 different people, I've been all pissy and moany with other people and blaming them when that happens. So maybe I need to look at that. And when I look at that and I let the raw core energy come to the surface in the presence of love, then healing occurs. And there is no tool that I know of on planet Earth besides first century Aramaic forgiveness that empowers people to consistently, persistently do that. Yes, there are accidental ways that people stumble across it and they get a piece of healing, and not understanding the principle involved, they often go off in some direction that doesn't have anything to do with the truth. But the bottom line truth of it is, if there's a hidden or dissociated part of the mind that I'm willing to receive feedback about and willing to allow it to come forward in the presence of active love, then healing occurs. And it doesn't matter where the energy is in tissue. If it's anywhere in your tissue structure and there's a disease going on, that disease can heal absolutely instantly on the spot. I've seen it happen over and over and over and over again. Yes, right up to and including cancers. But the unwillingness to love truth and let the truth come forward and look at it locks the disintegrative energy wherever it is in tissue, and that's the part of your structure that will keep nagging you in pain because there's an energy there that doesn't belong. Willingness allows it to come forward in the presence of love. Dissolution, forgiveness is the dissolution of that energy. And so that's what we're here to support. That's what we're here to understand. That's a basic bottom line of healing from the first century Aramaic language. And you go back to Yeshua 2,000 years ago, and this man was a physicist. This man was a psychologist. This man was not a theologian. He was a geneticist. He understood how the energy system worked. When they said the wages of sin is death, there was no threat in that whatsoever. It's just, here's how it works. You put an energy in that doesn't belong, and the tissue that it's in begins to fall apart. You get enough of that happening, and you die. Forgiveness is to drop into that part of your own mind and remove the part that holds that hostility or fear, rage, guilt, grief, whatever it happens to be. And so that's the bottom line of healing, and that's what we're here to support. And we're delighted that you're here to be part of the process. And, of course, the idea of the show is to be here as a space to open questions and to empower people by tapping into that first century Aramaic information and understanding. And, you know, not many people are going to spend, for me, the Aramaic specifically, I started working with that about 40 years ago. I was engaged in this work for approximately 10 years before that. But when I came into contact with the Aramaic, that was like the next huge opening and the next step. And so I've basically spent 40 years full time understanding the healing aspect, not the philosophical, not the theological, but the healing aspect of that first century teaching of this man named Yeshua. And we're here to support you. You're probably not going to spend 40 years of your life full time putting that all together. And so we're here to offer the best answers that we've got and support the process. And in this work, we define processing as the ability to keep love conscious, active, and present when something less than love comes up, to allow that which is less than love to come forward, and to stop the focus on everybody else's the problem in your life and start to own that, here I am. I'm the one in pain. I have a thought disorder. And when I bring that thought disorder, when I stop, you know, defending and I bring that thought disorder forward in the presence of active love, it dissolves and I am healed. It's just the way it goes. That's the healing core and the healing power of this man that was called the Great Physician. So this work is opposed to being about treatment. And, you know, treatment can be wonderful. No question about it. There have been some wonderful treatments that have been discovered for symptoms. But in the last analysis, treatment isn't healing. I think any medical professional that offers treatment without offering healing at the same time, without having educated themselves as healers and offering support for healing to people, I think that's criminal. To hold oneself out as a healer, as one who heals others, and offers treatment only, but no deeper insight into the dynamics of what are going on within the structure of the individual and cleaning that up. I think it's just really, it's a sham, and it has created so much suffering in our world today. And it's time to put an end to suffering. If you're acquainted with Yeshua and what he taught, and you actually engage in what he taught, not believe in what he taught, but engage it, your suffering's over. And or you'll come in touch with layers of suffering that you need to clean up. And as you clean it up, as you do your work, those layers of suffering just disappear and dissipate. That's the whole bottom line. And what's left when you do that process? Being, hold the newborn, that's what's left. Literally the awesome active presence of love. It's who we are. It's what we're designed for. And so that's what we're here to support and be part of. And if you're out there and you have any questions for us, if you're on one of those stations where we can't see you, our call-in number is 563-999-3581, 563-999-3581. If you're in the chat room and you have a question, you want to dial that number, you'll be listening to the show. And then if you push one, a little hand will go up in the control panel, and Jeannie will know you want to talk to us, and we'll have a conversation. So, Jeannie, do we have anything happening in the chat room or anybody in the control room with a question for us?
There's just one other person listening in the chat room, but they're not on there where they can talk. And there's a lot of people on the switchboard, but nobody has their hand up. So we have 18 minutes. If someone presses one, we've got plenty of time for a conversation.
So how can we support you? What's on your mind? If I had been in your hometown, if I were there today and just walked down off of a platform after saying what I just said, you know, I'm in your local university or your local church, your local library, your local prison or whatever, and I just shared what I shared, and I walked down off the platform, I've completed my presentation. I know that virtually everybody who's listening on the switchboard would walk over to me and say, well, Michael, what about? And that's what this space is for, those what about questions. Now, if, you know, you're listening and you go, well, my voice is a little shaky. I don't know if I want to. Well, can you make it okay for your voice to be shaky?
You've got a hand up.
And go ahead, push one and ask your question.
Up.
Go for it. All right, let's go for it.
All right. They both hit at the same time. I think one is Tim and one is Susan, so I'm going to put them both on. 610, you're on the air.
Well, hey, young lady, I was thinking about texting you folks this morning to see how your eye is doing, Tim, so I'm glad you're here. How are you doing?
Well, a little better. Hi, Sue.
It's moving in the right direction.
But in the same time I did.
I know. That's weird. We didn't
great minds think alike, right?
Right.
Great minds think alike.
He's in a different room. Yeah.
Aha.
Well,
yeah.
Power of resonance. What I wanted to ask,
go for it,
Michael,
Tim,
is how do we know that the Kabouris manuscript isn't translated from a Greek translation? How do we know that it was directly written by an eyewitness or somebody else, not from the Greek?
Well, the imprimatur, it'd be kind of like, you know, you being a lawyer, a notary today would certify. How do I know that, you know, this is an actual court document? Well, there's a notary who certified it. Now, do notaries lie? Yeah, it's been known to happen. But generally speaking, if you have a notarized document, you can trust it, right? So there's
right.
an imprimatur, a page at the beginning of the manuscript that would be the equivalent of the notary's page of a bishop of the Church of Nineveh, which would have been one of the largest churches in that area in the Turkey. The manuscript was found in the Kaibor River in Turkey. So that would have been one of the largest churches around 1000 A.D. And that imprimatur, which is, and we've had the manuscript carbon dated twice now, actually, at the University of Arizona, which is kind of a primo carbon dating facility. And they tell us that the manuscript is A.D. 1000 plus or minus 50 years. And the imprimatur says that it's a copy of a 164 A.D. text. So that makes it a copy of the earliest known first century manuscript of the Aramaic. So that's our verification, or at least the imprimatur. That's the notary. And then you just take it and you put it to work. Does it work? And if it works, then I think we've got pretty good verification that it's accurate.
How do we know that the one that it was copied from wasn't a translation from the Greek? How do we know that was also in Aramaic? Does
well,
the imprimatur say that?
Well, I no, the imprimatur doesn't say, and this wasn't copied in 164 AD or from a 164 AD text. It does not say that. But here's how we know. We look at the Greek translations that are so silly and off the wall and ridiculous that are not in the Kabouris manuscript. So let's say, for instance, let me get my brain to some of the mistranslations the Greek put into it. Well, let's take this one of love your neighbor. The Greeks say love your neighbor. The Kabouris manuscript doesn't say love your neighbor. It says have rachm for your neighbor. And rachm is this filter in the frontal lobes of the brain. It has nothing to do. So there are several places where the Greek mistranslations simply don't appear. And that would be our next step in verifying, is this a copy of a Greek text? And no, it's not.
Okay.
Yes, I know there are people out there saying, oh, yes, the Peshitta was just a copy of the Greek. But the mistakes that don't appear, for me, come to a standard. And it's interesting, you know, Dan McDougall that I spoke about earlier was an attorney. And in doing the translation work, he directed the translation with these 25 translators, and he used the rules of evidence as developed for a courtroom to determine what gets into the translation as to whether or not it's accurate. And the mistranslations that the Greeks put in there just don't exist in the Kabouris.
Okay, that makes sense. What did you want to ask, Sue?
Oh,
I like this question that you asked, Tim. That's been on my mind, too, but I just didn't think it was answerable, so I appreciate your answer, Michael. Tim's sister has been an experiential Aramaic scholar for years. In fact, she went to one
your
early workshops. Her name is now Rachmaneh Myers. She calls herself Rachmaneh, but she might have been Claudia.
Obviously
Claudia
from the Aramaic.
Becken. Yeah,
right.
Well, I've been talking
well,
to
tell
her
I
about
said hello.
I will. She gets pretty hot under the collar about this whole thing. She says a great deal of precious material was suppressed because of institutional preferences and patriarchal mind stuff. And
yeah.
She said George Lamsa.
She's right.
And, you didn't want to say it, but she just said, for me, I don't concern myself with the scholarly picking apart of this and that. What I do is just what you do, Michael. I apply it. And if it fits and helps me grow and helps me heal, this is what I'll use. And it's the Aramaic every time. And yet it's very interesting. I've had talks with my daughter, who is a traditional Episcopal priest, and she says, no, the Koine Greek was the first because Aramaic was not a written language, but it had the same alphabet as Hebrew. So it makes me think, why then was it not written? If there was a written alphabet, it must have been
if
written.
If there was an alphabet.
Yeah.
Well, so, and, you know, you can go back even in the Greek translations. There's one particular place where the final words on the cross that Yeshua speaks and what the Greek translators say in that passage is, and we've left this in the original Aramaic. Aramaic was a written language. There's just no question and no doubt whatsoever.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Greek scholars in their ivory towers, and, you know, just take a look around the country and how many Greek scholars sit in their ivory towers making their, you know, $80,000, $100,000, $200,000, $500,000 a year, whatever they're doing from their scholarship. What happens to that whole system if one day they all wake up and say, you know something? It wasn't Greek to start with. It was Aramaic. And therefore, I know nothing, and I have to start over. And now my whole financial structure collapses. How much blockage of truth do you suppose that induces into the conversation?
Oh, of course.
So it's just,
of course.
It's like, you know, it's silly. But and you mentioned Lamsa and Rachmaneh's conversation about Lamsa. You know, he worked at Unity Village at the time when he was doing his translation work. And this was a point where, you know, the good Christian folks were literally threatening to string him up, to kill him.
Oh, my God.
And I understand that he said that in his translation, he made approximately 1,600 changes out of what he said should have been 10,000. In translating and bringing it back to accuracy from the Greek to the Aramaic. And he made those changes because the others, he was afraid they would literally kill him.
Oh, my God.
You know, there's quite a bit of viciousness and violence in the mind of the so-called theologian that is challenged with, here's what the man said in Aramaic, and then here's what the Greek translations are. Yeshua did not think in Greek. He did not speak in Greek. And, you know, as my simple example of, you know, you've got a low body temperature. I mean, just take something as simple as that and multiply that by 1,000 instances where the Aramaic is it's a small language. There aren't a lot of words in Aramaic. And so there are multiple meanings, and there are deeply meaningful passages that are totally and completely idiomatic. And you can be the best translator in the world, and you can't translate an idiom. You've just got to know what the idiom means.
Right.
So...
Right. Well,
the final is. Go ahead.
You go ahead. For you, the final is.
No, I was just going to agree with Rothman A that, you know, it's not about belief. It's about if you apply it, does it work? There's the ultimate verification. If you apply Greek, love your neighbor. Well, look at how many people are out there slaughtering each other in the name of Christ.
I know.
You know, I come to bring you the love of my master Christ. If you won't accept it, I'll kill you. Excuse me. Something's wrong with that translation.
I know it.
Something's off the wall.
Oh, I know it. It's so disturbing. Oh, yeah.
Something
well, one thing she did say.
Really?
Yeah. One thing she did say is 80% of what Christians have in our culture from the Greek is okay. And now maybe that's, I was surprised it was so much, considering what you said about Lanza and the thousands more corrections he would have made. She said 80%, I mean, we can limp along, and we are limping along. We're doing terribly in some departments, but she said, this is the way it's going to be. But for her, she is Tim's and her mother was Jewish, and so she has studied Judaism. And at her mother's funeral, she actually said the Lord's Prayer in Aramaic and or Hebrew. What was it, Tim? Was it Aramaic or Hebrew? I think it was Aramaic. Yeah. Anyway, she's one of the Unity people. You know, just trying to find the truth in any tradition, but mainly focused on Christianity because that's how she was reared, more or less. And her parents were not practicing either way, particularly. And I'm sort of going off here, but
And Aramaic predated Hebrew. Hebrew Arabic is a daughter language of Aramaic.
Wow.
They're offspring languages, both Arabic and Hebrew. In fact, I can remember Dan, way back, this goes back 50 years ago, Dan went into and taught a piece of the emotional maturity instruction in a synagogue in Atlanta. Mm. And the rabbi of the synagogue afterward just lavished praise on him and said, thank you for teaching us how to understand our language again.
Oh, how gorgeous.
I was introduced to a rabbi in South Florida. Actually, I've got a phone call that came in last night from the fellow who introduced me. This goes back about 15 years ago. And, you know, he was sharing. He's a congregant of this rabbi, the gentleman who introduced us, and he shared, this is just so on target with what we are working with. And he introduced us, and when I met him and said, well, you know, our work goes back and we're working with the Aramaic. I mean, he literally, this guy's about 6'6". I was sitting at his kitchen table, and I'd never had a schnozzle before, but this guy's about 6'6". When I said I was working with the Aramaic, he's like, well, all of our wisdom keepers in the Judaic tradition were Aramaic. And he got up from his seat and he came over and put his arms in. So let me give you a schnozzle. He gave me this big hug, and he's like, yes, please come and speak at our synagogue.
Mm. Wow.
It's all Aramaic. It isn't Greek.
Wow,
just,
that's so exciting. That's
isn't.
So exciting.
Yeah. Mm.
Well,
it's powerful.
It's been very fun to talk to her because she has been pushing our reading and informing ourselves about Aramaic for years and years and years and kept running up against stone walls, particularly with Tim's after Tim's father died, his mother remarried a wonderful Christian man who was very open-minded too, but he used to argue against her arguments for the Aramaic being the real thing. And he said things like, yes, the Aramaic is an interesting language. It hasn't got much vocabulary, so you could put a number of meanings on any one word, and you can make it pretty much say what you want. And so we're not going to do that. And that was, Tim, that was Bob Burge. And so that was the end of all that.
We'll go to the Greek. We'll go to the Greek where we've already established what those meanings are going to be in advance.
Right. I know. Oh,
rather than,
we didn't even.
Okay. rather than saying, ah, so clearly, with it being a small language and multiple meanings, which is true, and many idioms, which is true, rather than, well, then we're going to have to do an intensive scrutiny so that we can establish what those words actually meant in the first century. And that's what Dan did with 25 translators. I mean, he was paying 25
that's
different
fabulous.
Of the world's top Aramaicists, and he would send a passage out to all 25 of them, get the translations back, and if they weren't accurate, or pardon me, if they weren't consistent, he'd send it back out and say, something wrong here, and, you know, we need to do more work on this. And then when 25 translators all agreed and said, this is it, then it still wasn't considered that the translation was accurate. The next step was, in order to verify it, was, and this was the part that I played in it, I don't speak, read, or write the Aramaic language. As the director of the Kabbalah Foundation, I'm not allowed to. And what happened is we take what the translator said then and bring it into the laboratory, the classroom, you know, like an intensive. You know, you came to a laboratory when you guys came to that intensive this summer. And does it work? Once we had the consistency of the 25 translators and then it worked, we said, okay, now we've got something that is valid.
Wow. How far along are you?
You know, there's not really a way. I don't have a way that I can quantify how much of the translation has been done or not been done. It's really going to take having the funding and starting the translation work up again and gathering a team that's capable of taking it to the next level to really establish that and see where it needs to go. And so, and of course, we don't know what we don't know yet from the Aramaic.
Yeah.
But what we do know certainly opens a space for monumental healing. And so we know we've got a significant amount of it accurately understood. And it'll be nice when we get it heading off to the next level, when we've got the funding to do that.
And a really basically very important part, the important part about healing is it. I mean, isn't that pretty much it? We'd love to have other stuff, but if we're applying this, we could do a heck of a lot of healing in the world.
Everything else is handled. Absolutely. Yeah. That takes care of it all. That's the core of it.
Oh, boy.
I'm in agreement, and we're down to the last few seconds. So I'm going to say thank you, Tim, for opening with that question, and Susan, for continuing the conversation. Tell Rachmaneh I said hello. I'd love to chat with her, love to have her come on the show, and let's have a conversation. In the meantime, everybody, have the best year yet of your eternal life. It is an awesome gift to give the world.